This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan.
Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable. I'm your host, Post-Gazette Sports Editor Jerry Micco, and I'm joined in studio today by the PG's Colin Dunlap and weekend host of The Fan, John Phillips. And guys, on this week's show, we're going to take a look at the Pirates, a little bit of Pirates down in spring training. We're also going to take a look at Pitt basketball following their tough loss in the Big East to UConn. And then we're going to wrap it up with the Penguins, who later today play Montreal up at the Consol Energy Center. And, guys, I'm going to start with the Pirates. And, Colin, I'll start with you. You're the beat writer. And you've been spending a little time at home. You got a new family, twins. Congratulations here on the air. It's the first time you've been on the show in a while.
Thank you much.
And you've been spending some time with your lovely wife and your kids. But have you been kind of keeping an eye on the Pirates? I know you have been.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. You were down there early this spring for the start of it, and I know you're keeping an eye on things now. Anything, we're halfway through spring training roughly, anything
right.
jump out at you?
Yeah, I was down there for a while, and I'm going back down in a few days. So what jumps out at me is, and it doesn't win or lose baseball games, I don't think, but atmospherically it's different with Clint Hurdle, and that jumps out at everybody, and I think that you can't help but notice that. But what you also can't help but notice is there has not been a significant upgrade in talent. And no matter who you bring in, you could bring in, Casey Stengel, you could bring in Connie Mack to manage this team, or you could bring in the greatest motivator ever, which Clint Hurdle sure talks like he's one of the greatest motivators ever, and I would line up behind the guy. But you have to upgrade in talent, and unless the pitching staff pitches over their heads or a couple of those guys get a lot better, which I think Ross Ohlendorf will get a lot better, then I just don't see them improving all that much. Mm-hmm. I think offensively they can do some things. I think bullpen-wise they could do some things, but I just don't see the starting pitching being that good.
I think they need run support to help that pitching staff. That's definitely a big thing last year. So 3.5 runs a game is what they averaged, not nearly enough to support a pitching staff. And you mentioned Ross Ohlendorf. He was snake bit last year, injuries and just didn't seem like he had much luck. So I think, if they can get some more runs, it's going to definitely help their pitching staff, and hopefully they will show signs of improvement that way.
Colin, you mentioned pitching. You mentioned Clint Hurdle, who I think will bring some enthusiasm to that job. Now, that's easy to say now. When you're lost 65 and, in June, you're sitting there going, great, and you might get beaten down a little. But let's think right now. I agree. You mentioned pitching. You mentioned Ross Ohlendorf. I think it'd be better. Charlie Morton's had a nice spring.
Right.
Mahalam pitched 4 innings, gave up a run yesterday. He's had a nice spring. So you're seeing some of those starters do it. And you did a piece on Ray Searage.
Right.
The Pirates pitching coach. And do you think that he's going to have a positive effect? Is he the kind of guy, and you talked to him quite a bit, that is going to be able to maybe help these guys get over the hump? He's got some guys he's got a couple veterans. And he's got, but they're all veterans, but he's got some youngish guys too, guys like McDonald, guys like Ohlendorf, and Mahalam is kind of an in-between guy.
Well, with Ray, I don't think it's so much as what Ray can do. I think Ray's a fabulous pitching coach, and I think he's a really good guy who gets along with everybody on the staff, whether it be the closers, Hanrahan and Meek, whether it be the starters. I don't think it's as much as what Ray is doing as it's the divorce from Joe Kerrigan. Joe Kerrigan sort of rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I think when Charlie Morton started to go downhill, the spiral was because of Joe Kerrigan's inability to deal with Charlie Morton. And I've said this a few times. Ray Searage, to me, has figured out Charlie Morton in a sense. And the way to figure out Charlie Morton is to not try to figure him out. So it's little things like that Ray treats every pitcher independently. He doesn't try to put each one in the same canister. He doesn't try to program them. The feedback that I've gotten from pitchers who were on that staff before was that Joe Kerrigan tried to mold everybody into the same guy. That doesn't work. The divorce from Joe Kerrigan, it didn't matter who it was that they brought in. Somebody not named Joe Kerrigan was going to help this staff, but Ray Searage has done things absolutely the right way.
I would add that, Charlie Morton, we're going to find out what kind of character he has, especially kind of bouncing back. Same thing with Ohlendorf as well. And like you had talked about, Colin, having somebody in there new to, kind of guide these guys along. From what I was reading, by all accounts, Morton has added the slider back into his pitching rotation,
right. So
which is something he went away from last year. Maybe that's going to help him along the way, and we'll just have to wait and see. But I really do think more run support will help them ultimately more than maybe anything else.
This is probably not a great comparison, but just personality-wise, they remind me of one another. when I was a sports editor back in my before this job back on the West Coast, Barry Zito is this kind of a guy. Now, he had more talent than Morton. Well, maybe not. I mean, Zito was coming right out of college, but he was a high draft pick, had a live arm. But he was different. Here's a real different guy. And the A's knew right away. It's like, you know, if we try to mold him into what we're trying to do with Tim, because they had, at the time, they had Hudson and they had Mulder and Zito. They had all three of them at once. Mulder and Hudson you could work with a little bit, but Zito you had to kind of let go, and you know, he would fit into, you know, his own way. And I talk about Charlie Morton. Colin, is there any – I mean, has he done enough already? Does he need a couple more starts? Is he the number five starter on this team?
I think Charlie Morton is the fifth starter undeniably. I think that what it is they're just forcing him into competition to make him pitch in a competition atmosphere. But I think – absolutely, positively, he's the fifth guy, and Scott Olsen is a left-handed bullpen guy to complement Joe Bimel. If Joe Bimel is healthy, which I think Joe Bimel is healthy, so those will be the two bullpen guys. I would be stunned if Charlie Morton isn't the fifth starter. And again, I think that it's already – I think he's in the default position, and he would have to implode to lose it, and I don't see him losing it. He's regained his sinker. He's throwing the ball with a lot more confidence. He's throwing inside. And there's no way that Charlie Morton was as bad as what he was last year. I just think that his confidence got so beaten down, and he wasn't able to go to the guy who should have been there for him, who was Joe Carrigan, and have him be the man to help him out. Mm-hmm. And it was tough to watch, and you guys know this. It was tough to watch Charlie Morton last year go out there, and it seemed like there was a string of base hits, and then he just had that look like it's over, it's done, and it's finished. And I don't think that's going to happen. Now, is Charlie Morton going to win the Cy Young? Absolutely not. Let's sort of temper this conversation with, like, we don't expect this guy to win 15 games, but he will get better, and again, he is the fifth guy. I wouldn't be surprised if as the season goes along, he climbs into the third or fourth guy.
I would only add that I would like to see his, you know, obviously improvement from him, and it's really going to come with that, you know, support from again runs. I mean, just that sort of thing. When you're in a situation where you're down 3-4-0 already, and you give up a couple of hits, next thing you know, like you said, he's got that look on him. These guys, I think, really would feed off of, you know, having a small lead. You know, getting a lead mm-hmm. for these guys early on is going to help build a lot of that confidence for them. And you're right, he's not going to win 15 games. But if he does show some improvement this year, and if he can get that support from the pitching staff and, you know, the guys that are coaching him, we'll see much better results this year from him than last year.
Well, to get to that point a little bit, Colin, you've probably more than any sports journalist in Pittsburgh, you've probably spent more time talking to Pedro Alvarez before he was even a Pirate.
Right.
And you did so again this spring. Is it realistic for the Pirates to put on paper he's a 3,100, he's a 30 home run, 100 RBI guy? As we talk about, you know, having some pop in your bat and that team scoring more runs, he's going to have to provide it. He's going to bat in the cleanup spot. But is he a 3,100 guy yet?
I think it is. Especially, there's one component that will decide that, too, is if Andrew McCutchen hits third, that means that Alvarez will see more fastballs because people don't want a merry-go-round to happen with McCutchen running. Mm. And I think that Clint Hurdle hasn't really come out and said it, but if Tabata hits first and McCutchen hits third, that's just as much to do with Pedro seeing fastballs in the four-hole than he would with somebody else hitting third. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a 30 home run, 100 RBI guy, absolutely. Now, Alvarez is a strikeout guy, too. Let's remember right. this. He can't go through those spells like he has at every level, striking out, you know, 12 times in a week. Mm-hmm. He just can't do that. He has to get more consistent. I talked to a couple hitting guys, and he has been spraying the ball a little bit more. Yeah, he's a guy who's going to be asked to carry this team mm-hmm. power-wise on his back because Lau Overbay, he hit 30 home runs last year. I don't think he can do that again this mm-hmm. year. So Alvarez will be asked to do that, and I think that the best thing for him will be McCutchen hitting in front of him if McCutchen hits third, which I think, as an opinion, I think he should.
Yeah, he probably should.
I totally agree. I think the guys in front of him, what they can do, are going to predicate what he's going to see in terms of pitches. Maybe just on talent alone, he can get 30 and 100. And that's something that they're going to need from him. The guys in the 5 and 6 spot might actually benefit from that as well.
Well, they might, and I know that they're moving guys around. Walker may hit fifth. He may hit second some days. You know, I mean, they're moving some guys around. And I think, Colin, they're going to be a little bit creative and still a little bit fluid with that batting order.
Well, they are. Well, I think that the days of, like, Brett Butler and Ricky Henderson hitting in the number one spot, like, that day of that kind of leadoff hitter may be gone. It's okay to have kind of a free swinger sort of leadoff guy. That's all right because he can give you a double every once in a while.
Right.
He can give you a home run out of the chute every once in a while. The days of that, you know, tiny, diminutive sort of guy is maybe gone, and Tabata should be the leadoff guy.
All right, guys, next up we're going to talk Pitt basketball. This is the Sports this is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back to the show. I'm with Post-Gazette's Colin Dunlap and Fan 93.7, and the Fan 93.7 weekend anchor and weekend host. He's a man of many titles, John Phillips.
You need your laundry done.
No, absolutely not. I would not ask you to do that. You got too many other jobs going on. Hey, guys, you know, Pitt just had a heartbreaking loss in the Big East basketball tournament, that dreaded double bye, as they like to say. But Kemba Walker hit one heck of a shot to beat him in the final second, 76-74. So they're out of it. They're taking time off for the NCAA tournament. And, you know, John, I'll start with you on this one. So in your mind, just right up front, this is what's on everybody's mind in Pittsburgh, are the Panthers – a number one seed in the NCAA tournament?
Well, I said last week that nothing was for sure. A lot of people thought that they had it locked up. Some people still think that they're in that fourth spot. They might get that bid to the West. Obviously, it's going to depend on what goes on with Notre Dame, if they can get to the conference finals, maybe even win it all, what happens with Duke and the ACC. Right now, they're definitely on a bubble right and waiting for what's going to shake down across the country. It's not the end of the world, but they didn't help themselves in terms of securing that number one. I definitely thought that they needed to at least get to the conference semifinals or finals to assure themselves of a number one seed. But it's not like they lost to an Old Dominion or a Dayton yesterday or some middle-of-the-road team. They lost to a pretty good basketball team who's got a Hall of Fame coach on their bench. You know, it's no consolation, but they're definitely in trouble in terms of a number one seed.
Colin, is it pretty much out of the question? Are they going to take their body of work and say, hey, this is number one team? They were 27-4. In the regular season and won the Big East regular season title.
No, I think they're number one seed undeniably. I think that their only bad loss, quite obviously, is to Tennessee, which, remember, it was played in Pittsburgh, but it was a neutral site game.
Right.
It wasn't really a home game. You know, it was at the new arena. I think they're a number one seed. I think if you look at the body of work and what they did, particularly in the conference that everybody wants to bill as the best conference in America, that powerhouse conference with 16 teams, and the run that they made and the road games that they won in that conference, I think they're still a number one seed because of what they did in December and January, not because of what they did yesterday.
Well, guys, I'm going to bring in someone who follows this stuff for a living and follows college sports for a living, a guy named Mike Huguenin. And Mike is the college sports editor of Rivals.com. Mike, hey, thanks for taking the time to join us here on the roundtable.
Yeah, appreciate you having me on.
All right, Mike, I'll ask you the same question. In your bracket, is Pitt a number one, or is it going to mean is Notre Dame going to have to lose in the Big East tournament for Pitt to get the number one seed?
I actually think both Big East teams are going to be number ones, along with Ohio State and Kansas. I think the Duke is the only team that could sort of sneak in and take the number one seed away. You know, Pitt, its regular season body of work, tremendously impressive, winning the Big East regular season title outright, winning three games without their best player, Ashton Gibbs, winning games on the road, and the other guy mentioned the loss to Tennessee. Tennessee's actually a top 40 team RPI, so that's not a bad loss. So obviously, if you're Jamie Dixon, I think you wanted to win at least once more, just not to have the long layoff in between games. But I don't think they did not lose a number one seed by losing to UConn.
Mike, were you a little surprised that the big man Gary McGee ended up on Kemba Walker for that last play yesterday?
I don't think that's what Dixon wanted. Now, McGee he plays because of his defense and his rebounding, but you don't want a 6'11 guy covering somebody as quick as Kemba Walker.
Mike, here in Pittsburgh, we look at everything in a vacuum and kind of everything provincially as sort of Pittsburgh sports journalists, but how does the nation look at what Jamie Dixon and kind of even back to Ben Hallen has done, but then conversely, Mike, what they haven't done in terms of getting to the Final Four? Is it more that people look at it positively in what they've done, or negatively that they're the one, maybe one or a couple of the programs that hasn't made that jump to the Final
Four?
Yeah,
I think unfairly it is the case of the latter. I think Dixon won't truly be known as an elite coach until he gets to the Final Four. He's taken what Ben Hallen built and turned it into one of the top 10 programs in the country, but there is that, Pitt, as good as they are, they haven't been in the Final Four, so you really can't talk about Dixon in that realm. But I think if you look at Pittsburgh, from the outside, a tremendous program, a defense-oriented program, not the sexiest program because of the emphasis Dixon places on defense. But, you know, I think there were some doubts about how good a coach Jamie Dixon was. I think he dispelled those last season. This season, you know, again, winning the regular season title in the Big East, it is the best league to me by far. They, you know, they win it outright. He is an elite coach, but I got to think that in his heart of hearts, there is a huge hole on his own resume in his own mind because, hey, I haven't been to the Final Four yet. Maybe you know, there is not an elite team nationally this year, and I think Pitt has as good a chance as maybe anybody but Ohio State to get to the Final Four this year.
If I had to hold you down, Mike, and make you just give one answer as to why they haven't been there, is it because they haven't had that, you know, prolific wing score? Is that why it is?
Yeah, I think it's they're not really that explosive on offense, and I think that has held them back some. They're always going to give phenomenal effort. They're always going to get in your face defensively. They're always going to play fundamentally sound basketball, but I think the lack of an explosiveness, the lack of overall explosiveness on offense has been the number one problem.
Mike, isn't that the trade-off when you're going for guys that play gutty defense?
Well, you're right. I mean, yeah. I think that's the perception of Bid Howland, too. He takes, you know, three teams in a row to the Final Four at UCLA. Well, he's never going to win one until he loosens the rein on the offense. You know, it's instead of praising him for getting there three times in a row in a 65-team field, it was, well, look at Howland. He doesn't know how to have his players run an offense. So, I think there is some truth to that, but I mean, you know, Dixon does have good athletes and they play lockdown defense. Not every coach can get their players to do that. But I think this, in terms of talking to our guys who cover recruiting, sometimes it can be a tough sell if Pitt's trying to get a high school kid who averages 30 a game. He might say, hey, look, I can go to UConn and be a freewheeler like El Amin was, like Rip Hamilton was, like Kimba Walker was, or I can go to Pitt and average 16 a game like Ashton Gibbs and have to bear down on defense for 40 minutes.
Speaking with Mike Huguenin of Rivals.com, he's the college sports editor there here on the Roundtable. Mike, I have a question about Pitt in the tournament. Is there a characteristic, or in your mind, what about this team do you think will allow them to make, say, a deep run in the tournament? My backup question always is, what is it that will hold them from holding back from making that deep run? What is it do you think maybe this team can make a deep run in this year's tournament?
Well, they've obviously went in the Big East. They've seen a wide variety of offenses, a wide variety of defenses. They should be ready for anything that's thrown at them. They're a physical group. They play tremendous defense, and they're well coached. I mean, it's a smart, high IQ basketball team that's well coached, and I think that's going to take them a long way. I think the one thing that could keep them from getting to the Final Four again is, as good as Ashton Gibbs is, I'm not sure there's another guy on the team that I would consider if Gibbs isn't in the game, for instance, who does Pitt go to make the shot? And, you know, Wanamaker's a talented player. I don't think he's that guy. Gilbert Brown, I don't think he's that guy. So, maybe the lack of a number two, you know, not that the lack of a number two scorer, because they got guys who can score. I think Gibbs, the hole behind Gibbs in terms of a high-powered score is something that's going
to
hurt.
Mike, to use a sort of a baseball parallel, that AL East chews the Red Sox, the Yankees, and the Rays. They chew each other up during the regular season. Does the Big East, for any Big East team, does it chew each other up too much, and that come tournament time, it's you've shot all your bullets pretty much?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think, the losing early in the Big East tournament might actually be a positive for some teams. I think you do want to win, you know, at least one in the Big East tournament, but there is going to be a layoff. But I think the time you get to regroup between the end of the Big East tournament and the start of the NCAA tournament is a positive. Plus, again, I think the wide variety of offenses and defenses in that league. Providence doesn't play defense, but runs up and down the court. You're used to that offense. You're used to the Syracuse zone. You're used to Georgetown and Princeton offense. There's a lot of different styles of play in the Big East, and nothing that Pitt or UConn or Marquette or Syracuse sees in the NCAA tournament should surprise them at all.
Mike, real quickly, let's say Pitt does get one of those four number one seeds and they end up maybe getting sent to the West. Because of the pod system and way the things are set up these days, it's not really that much of a disadvantage. I mean, they may have to travel to Cleveland. They may have to go to D.C. perhaps. I guess it really depends on where it all plays out. But if they get put into the West as a number one, does that really affect them all that much?
Yeah, it would if you get to the Sweet 16. It is going to be a difficult. It's difficult for fans to travel across the country for a Sweet 16. At the same time, I think the keys are, you're right, you want to be close to home for the first and second rounds. And the NCAA, the way the pot system works, is they quote-unquote protect their top four seeds in each region in the first and second round. So I think, yeah, Pitt, on the face of it, they're going to be shipped west. It's not nearly as big a deal as it used to be.
Mike, is that just a product also of you know, the way they do it now, and they seed, I know they seed everybody 1 to 65, but this year they're going to seed 1 to 68. So some of these play-in games and you know, the pod system that they use, now you've got play-in games that could be 11 or 12 seeds, right?
I mean, yes, exactly.
You've got some. So, I mean, are you looking at bubble teams? Like, who are a couple of your bubble teams?
Well, I think, if St. Mary's gets in, I would imagine they're going to be a 12. Boston College, Virginia Tech, Clemson, all looking at 12s. Michigan State could be a 12. Richmond could be a 12. I think some coaches, if you're in the play-in game, are going to say, hey, that's fine with me because, hey, I'm in the field, and, hey, I will have played 2 days before I play in the real first round, so my players are going to be ready. I think that the negative is, this year, this is a horrible at-large pool. I think, of the first 11 conference tournaments that were played, only two number one seeds won. So I think a strong case can be made that this is going to be the weakest NCAA field ever. And you just thank God they didn't expand to 96, because if you talk about teams like, is Minnesota going to get in? Is Northwestern going to get in? Is Cal going to get in? So as bad as this field has the potential of being, it could have been far, far worse.
Mike, thanks for taking the time to join us today. It's always good to hear from you.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mike. That was Mike Huguenin, College Sports Editors of Rivals.com. Up next, we talk Penguins here on the Post-Gazette Roundtable on 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back to the show. I'm with the PG's Colin Dunlap and Fan weekend host and anchor John Phillips. Guys, the Penguins play Montreal today at Consol Center, and the Habs will be without forward Max Pacioretty, who has had head and neck injuries after a savage hit along the boards by Boston's Zdeno Chara. While Chara was given a match penalty and thrown out of the game, he was not disciplined by the NHL any further. They deemed it as just a hockey hit, and they didn't penalize him at all. But now police officials in Quebec are starting to investigate the incident. How far that'll get, we'll have to see. That's down the road. But, John, the NHL is in a position where they've got to do something, I think, about head injuries and take more measures to prevent them. I mean, their poster guy, Sidney Crosby, and he's still out with a concussion he suffered apparently in a game against Tampa Bay a couple months ago. And is there something the league needs to do here? And was the Chara incident time to do that? Or is it just time for the league to take a much broader look at this and beyond what they already have on the books?
Yeah, if it's not their top priority when now or as soon as the offseason comes to pass, it should be for sure. I mean, the Chara hit, what happened on Monday, I mean, I think it was obviously the timing or the placement of where the hit took place was bad. I don't think, he was looking and said, if I hit this guy, his head's going to hit this post coming along the sideboard here. It just, kind of where those guys were at on the ice. And it was very violent and very ugly. Chara seems to find himself in these situations. And that's certainly not good. The league should have probably suspended him for a few games. I mean, the Air Canada Center is threatening to take away major sponsorship dollars from the NHL because of all of this. I mean, when you're getting fallout like that from your sponsors, the league definitely needs to, address it. And they need to address it right away. And they haven't done that. It's Saturday. This hit happened, on Monday evening, I think it was? Yeah. So, I mean, it's 6 days, nothing really from the league so far. And it is definitely an issue that they need to get to right away if they want to, save fans from flocking away. And if they want to try to cultivate new fans, which is what you want to do with your sport. You want to not only keep your fan base happy, but you want to grow. And that's something the NHL needs to definitely look at.
Well, Montreal's in town today, so that brings a story right to our doorstep. And one of the people who will be covering that is the Post-Gazette's hockey writer, Shelley Anderson. And she joins us now on the roundtable. Shelley, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Shelley, I'll ask you the same question. You saw, obviously, the Chara hit and you have covered the Penguins for a number of years now, and you know about the Sidney Crosby situation and what's going on there. Is the NHL, and you're going to be at the general manager's meetings next week where they're going to talk about this, is this something that the league is going to have to get resolved rather quickly?
Well, I don't know how much of a resolution they will be able to come up with or that there actually is, but I'm sure that player safety, if you want to look at the kind of broader topic, is going to be something that's really looked at by the general managers. And they don't have, as we saw last year when they instituted Rule 48 concerning hits to the head, they don't have broad powers to just enact changes, mm-hmm. but their recommendations are very much taken into strong consideration and often are incorporated in the rules during the off season when the Board of Governors can take a look at things. And so I think that that's going to be a major part of what they're talking about Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, next week when the general managers get together. Whether they want to ban all headshots or they just want to maybe look at stiffer extra disciplines such as fines and suspensions, things like that to work as a deterrent. And then they will have to decide whether these are things that players can, in the course of games, avoid. If they really have the control, the body control, and with the speed and power of the game today, to have the control to not come up with these terrible injuries that happen as a result of hits in games.
Shelley, real quick, for some of our listeners who may not know how this works exactly, the general managers don't necessarily make the rules. Right? It has to go before the Board of Governors, which is essentially the owners. Isn't that kind of how it works?
Yeah, although the owners usually take the general manager's recommendations very seriously, and usually if the general managers, through their thoughtful process, come up with something, they're usually backed by the league and the Board of Governors, and the Players Association has to get involved too.
Shelley, you know, you talk about Rule 48 and some of the other stuff to protect the players here in the NHL. Do you find that sometimes in the NHL there's an imbalance where sometimes the intent is punished, sometimes the punishment isn't until the result is found out, that there's no sort of hard and fast rules, though? Is that where there's a gray area, Shelley, and that causes sort of a quizzical atmosphere?
Absolutely. There's those things. And, you know, intent is so subjective. You can't always know, you know, what the intent is, and so therefore sometimes you look at reputation. They do have a situation where they look at repeat offenders, and they're supposed to be punished a little more severely than those who've been playing the game and have never been brought before a hearing or never had a suspension or a fine or something like that. So, you know, whether they can kind of bring that together and make it a little more standardized is something they might want to look at.
Well, to me, it just screams of, it's not very good. It's kind of like that whole bleeding stuff. Okay, if I hit a guy, it's a couple more minutes for bleeding. If I draw blood, well, the intent could be the same. It just doesn't, it's an imbalance and an inequity, Shelley, and it doesn't make any sense to me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're right. Intent is so difficult to interpret and to assign. And that's where they need to look and see if they can do something, I guess.
Here's the vicious cycle that I see with it. If Chara doesn't get a suspension or isn't fined heavily, the fighting continues. And there's obviously the recent outcry for banning fighting in the NHL. You know, how quickly does the NHL have to move on stiffer penalties to maybe limit the fighting? And can you really eliminate fighting completely from hockey?
I don't know. I mean, sure you can. I mean, you just legislate it out. I mean, but I get the feeling that the people who make those decisions are very much against that. For lots of reasons, for the old boys club, for tradition, for an old thought that if you let guys just go ahead and square it up and fight fair to fair, man to man, it eliminates some of the other stuff that you're using a stick as a weapon or the blindside hits that really can injure. You don't see a lot of major injuries in fights. So there's going to be a lot of resistance. I don't know if they'll ever legislate fighting out of the game.
If that's the case, is it going to take somebody being paralyzed or perhaps dying from some sort of freak accident for that to actually happen?
Even if that happens, unless it's in a fight, I still don't see. I see most of the people in hockey looking at that as two different issues, and fighting is not considered in the same category by a lot of people as hits to the head or dangerous hits or what we saw with Chara's hit on Catchy Ready, where he ended up with severe injuries.
We're talking with the Post-Gazette's Shelley Anderson, a hockey writer, and here on the Post-Gazette Roundtable on 93.7 The Fan. Shelley, what's Gary Bettman's role in all this? I thought yesterday, and as part of the Chara story, there is, and John brought this up earlier, that Air Canada has said unless the NHL kind of gets its act together on this, they're going to pull their advertising. And I was stunned. Actually, I was stunned because in this day and age, you usually don't see this. Gary Bettman's thing was they have a great brand. We have a great brand. If they want to spend their money somewhere else, go spend it somewhere else. I mean, essentially, a league that I think is relatively cash poor because they don't really have a great TV contract, that Gary Bettman kind of said, well, you know, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. What's his role in all this, and how do you see him? Do you hear anything about him getting somewhat more involved, or is he just kind of dispassionate about it and just kind of stays out of the way?
You know, it's always hard to read Gary Bettman. He's not an overly demonstrative type of person. Obviously, as with any sport, the commissioner is always going to be kind of beholden to the board of governors, the owners. He's kind of on the opposite side of the players and the Players Association, if you look at it politically. But as commissioner, you'd hope that he wants to see all avenues looked at and all facets of the game to be at their top. At the same time, with the Air Canada thing, I know they're a major sponsor for the six Canadian teams, but you can't have a sponsor writing your rules. I mean, if the league has to take a hit financially and step back that way, then they have to. But you can't, you know, if you let Air Canada do that, then you have to let other, you know, Tim Hortons or whoever else or local sponsors, Dick's Sporting Goods, you have to let them tell you what you can and can't do within the game. And you just can't, I don't think that you can let anybody erode the integrity of your game that way. So it's a tough situation, and I don't know if Air Canada is going to follow through on that, or, you know, sometimes things are said in anger and after a situation, after a hit like that. And, you know, would Air Canada have gotten involved if it was the other way around, if a Bruins player had gotten hit by a Montreal player and gotten hurt?
Well, Shelley, that leads me to my next question. It is the fact that this story has now, it was a vicious hit. Whether it was dirty or not, it was a vicious hit. I really don't know. Anyway, my point here is, you know, you talk about a major sponsor. Doesn't Molson own the Canadiens?
Yeah, and you've got Air Canada Center where the Toronto Maple
Where the Maple Leafs are, and Molson Company, the brewery, owns the Canadiens. And, you know, here's one of their the Skyans out there yesterday saying we're against this. We think we got, you know, essentially got jobbed by the NHL on this. And you know, again, where were they when Mark Savard got hit by Matt Cook, which was a dirty hit, I think? Where were they on the Andy Sutton hit on Pascal Dupuis? No one really said much about that. The sponsors certainly weren't there.
Right. I mean, I guess because those particular games or those teams or those players were not of high interest to them. And the teams that they specifically sponsor or the teams that they specifically follow. So that's why I don't think you can, you know, as tough as it might be, you just can't let the sponsors dictate how you run your game. I mean, I think you have chaos if that happens, and I don't think you have a real league, a real professional league. So, you know, as much as it hurts, you'd have to let them walk. But I'm, you know, let's wait and see. I'm not sure that the Air Canada is really willing to follow through on that. And let's see what happens with it.
Shelley, how about I extract you from this abyss? What about the Bylsma extension? How's it going over in the room, and how do you think about it?
I think it's very well received. You know, I think that, as Ray Sherrill said, he talked to Dan Bylsma early in the season. It's probably getting a little close. I mean, you're talking about someone who was not contracted to the team beyond the end of the season, whenever that comes up. So they have to do something one way or another. And, you know, there's absolutely no reason to think that Dan Bylsma has not done everything to earn an extension. And 3 years is a pretty good commitment to a coach, considering how quickly NHL coaches have turnover in most franchises, and particularly with the Penguins over the years. I think it's a real nice reward for Dan Bylsma for the job he's done, both with a great team that he was able to right the ship and take to the Stanley Cup, and then with this team that's really taken some huge hits with injuries and still been able to keep things together and keep them competitive and keep them, you know, with some great carrots to go for, you know, with a possible Eastern Conference or Atlantic Division championships.
Well, Shelley, thanks for the knowledge. Great stuff today, and good luck at the game today.
Great. Thank you very much for having me, guys.
Okay. That was Shelley Anderson of the Post-Gazette hockey writer. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan.
You're listening to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. It's time for Fan Mail on the Post-Gazette Roundtable. Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan.
Welcome back to the Roundtable, and it's time for our Fan Mail segment. If you'd like to have your email read on the show, please email me at jmicco@postgazette.com. We'll consider it for a future show. And this week's letter is from Greg, who writes, "Rule changes enacted by the NHL in recent years have added more excitement than ever to the flow of Major League Hockey games, with one exception, the absurdity of which was highlighted in the March 5 Penguins-Devils game. The game ground to a halt as Chris Letang and Travis Zajac fought for no discernible reason. In its infinite wisdom, the NHL then assessed Letang a 5-minute penalty for fighting, but also a game misconduct for not having his sweater tied down. So repeatedly punching your opponent in the head is an NHL misdemeanor. Not tying your sweater down is an NHL felony. When will this league ever grow up?" Well, Greg, that's a good question. I think you're seeing a lot more people ask it right now. And it's in light, what's really brought it, shown the brightest light on it, is the recent Zdeno Chara hit on Max Pacioretty from Montreal, which was a vicious hit, a borderline dirty hit. But the NHL, Chara was penalized. He was thrown out of the game, given a match penalty. But the league did no sanction on it, saying it was a hockey play, it was a hockey hit, and it was an unfortunate hit. However, there's more to it than this. And part of it is right here in Pittsburgh, our own Sidney Crosby, who has been out 2 months plus with a concussion. Head injuries in hockey are part of the game. They happen. They can happen at any level. They can happen anywhere, and it's part of the game. But when the head injuries are coming from violent hits that are penalties in the game, Charles was a penalty. The hit on Crosby was a boarding penalty. You saw, many of you saw the hit that Gillies put on Tangrady in the Penguins Islanders game, the 300 penalty minute game, a vicious elbow to the head that caused another concussion. The problem isn't that these concussions aren't coming because of play. They're coming because of dirty hits, borderline hits. We all know about the Matt Cook, Mark Savard incident. The league has got to fix this, and they've got to fix it in some way, shape, or form. General managers will talk about it early next week. The board of governors will take it up at some point. You can't legislate every knock in the head out of hockey, but you can legislate the dirty hits that lead to it. And when you start taking out players and taking out the good young players, guys like Pacioretty, guys like Crosby, who are the face of the league has got to fix that issue, and it's an issue that isn't going to go away anytime soon. That does it for today's Post-Gazette Roundtable. I'd like to thank today's panel, Fan weekend host and anchor John Phillips, and the Post-Gazette's Colin Dunlap. I'd also like to thank our guests, Rivals.com college editor Mike Huguenin and the Post-Gazette's hockey writer Shelley Anderson. Also, many thanks to our producer Matt Popchak, who every week puts this show together for us, and we much appreciate it. And I hope you'll join us at the Roundtable next Saturday morning on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. I'm Post-Gazette Sports Editor Jerry Micco. Have a great week, everyone.